Hi, this is Roger Green, host of the Surfing the Mesh Tsunami podcast. This week, we're offering five conversations from episode 9, in which Hannes Hagström joins Jörn Schottenberg, Louise Campbell, and me to discuss recent work on in-office scanning, impact of different diet types, and patient prognoses. Plus, from the vault, a conversation from last year's EASL Congress about patient identification and screening along the clinical care pathway. Hannes Hagström starts this conversation by noting that one challenge with drugs will be knowing when to discontinue or to add a second agent to therapy since, as he points out, resmetirom will not be efficacious for all patients. This brings Jörn Schottenberg to the topic of predictive biomarkers, which will be specific to drugs or mode of action, and have not been studied much yet. Jörn is confident these will not be the biomarkers of today, but he's not clear about whether they should point to a genotype, mode of action, specific agent, something else. After some byplay about how quickly this could come about, say years versus decades, I suggest that one key to commercial success will be to identify this exact type of biomarker. Louise Campbell broadens our focus somewhat by noting that since changes in nutrition and physical activity will be part of any regimen, we may need to assess the impact of those separately as compared to the drug itself. Jörn describes his vision as kind of scary, it's a quote, but notes that diet and exercise labeling is standard for drugs in the U.S. exactly as it is with Rezdiffra, and these are not monitored closely. From there, we consider the type of study one might do to assess nutrition and physical activity independently, and why that might be extremely hard to do. Finally, we move on to the last question, which asks what steps each panelist believes will take place in the next 2 years to support improved triaging and patient management throughout the entire pathway. Four active minds produce more than four answers, not surprisingly. You'll have to listen to learn. It's striking how fast new research around issues of patient treatment and therapeutic options are stacking up, and how the number of questions grows even faster than the number of studies. This conversation covers several points, but it's pretty strictly focused on treating the right patients the right way at the right point in time with the right agent. So just sit back, listen, learn, enjoy, and when you're done, join the dialogue in our LinkedIn discussion group.
Hannes Hagström.
We mustn't forget that for most patients, they did not respond to the drug within 1 year. Of course, they might respond if you keep treating them. We don't know that yet. But at some point, we're going to probably have to recognize that, okay, this patient is not responding to this drug, and maybe we should stop for futility and cost saving and a lower risk for side effects. Or we should switch to another drug, or we should maybe combine with another drug. So we're going to have to do a lot of studies to build that framework also to see what should the treatment pathways look like. When do we stop treatment? When do we switch treatments? So I don't have any answers.
Jörn Schottenberg.
Yeah, this brings us into the topic of the type of biomarker we typically have not discussed so intensively here, which is the predictive biomarkers, right? Typically, we talk prognostic or diagnostic, but predicting who is going to respond to which treatment, that's really something we haven't seen a lot of. And the Madrigal people have published a biomarker that actually responds to thyroid hormone receptor beta agonism to measure with this sex hormone binding protein, which goes down in patients that are being exposed. Now, there was not a very strong correlation with histological treatment response, but I think it went that way, and we need some refinement of existing biomarkers to actually predict that. And I think, Hannes, it's probably not going to be the biomarker, because all the type of biomarkers we're using today, because the biomarkers are coined for liver histology, and I'm not sure they're really coined towards the mechanism of action of the specific drug. I mean, even if you consider a GLP-1, we've seen patients improve their liver health, albeit not losing a large amount of body weight. So there are some things that are more complex than predicting response based on one biomarker. And I'd like to see a specific biomarker for each MOA to understand when to change, how to change, and which other drug to use. That's going to be a lot of interesting.
Yeah, and then I partly agree with you, Jörn. I think that would be the optimal scenario, but it also sort of complicates the treatment landscape, and it makes it even more difficult for allowing primary care and so on to treat these patients, because if they're going to have to come up with, you also have to know these four mechanisms, and you have to take different blood tests each time to check for treatment response, it's going to be tricky for people to keep everything in mind, and the pathway algorithms we need to do will be impossible to fit on one page, probably. So that means we're probably going to be sort of treating these patients in hepatology for at least the first few years when we have drugs on the market and so on.
Roger Green.
At the risk of sounding like a pessimist, from the day that the cholesterol hypothesis became reasonably well accepted to the day that statins became widely available, you're talking about a period of 30 years. From the day that Nixon announced that the U.S. was going to start the war on cancer to the arrival of pembrolizumab, that's about 40, 45 years. So we're talking, if we think we can get this right in 7 years, we're really heroic. look, I got to tell you, Hannes, I'm hoping that my kids get to see this compared to my grandkids, because it certainly isn't going to be around for me. But
it definitely takes more people like Hannes and his group doing all the science.
You know, I'm a very, very impatient person, Roger. So, but some things you can't control, I guess. So, yeah, we'll see.
Look, we're more advanced in terms of how we think about these things than we used to be. And listening to you, one of the things that strikes me is that commercial success will, to a significant degree, not only go to a drug based on how well it works, but how well you can predict in whom it's going to work. Because the real misallocation of resources here will be about giving the wrong drug to the wrong patient once we have the ability to give the right drug to the right patient. And there, Jorn, I think your point about predictive biomarkers comes home to roost very, very powerfully. You know, the better job you can do of predicting what's going to work, or failing that, predicting what a fast failure looks like. You know, if I can look at adiponectin or something and figure out in 16 to 20 weeks that this isn't getting anywhere, that's multiply helpful to the system. That would be my thought.
Louise Campbell.
I think the other added complication onto that here, Roger, is resmetirom has been approved for those who are on dietary and exercise programs. Now, we have to therefore be able to monitor those patients that are on those programs to say who's not responding to them, who should be responding to them. Have they responded enough? Do we add resmetirom in all of those groups? And which one of those groups does better? Now, we can only do that if we already have serial fibro scans during those programs, or Ascopics or any of the other devices, to know that they're not responding, to be put on a medication, to then get futility. So there's all of those little branches, but it has been approved with those two things, not on its own, without, and a lot of our systems are not structured for that.
Yeah, Louise, I think this is kind of scary for the hepatology field because we haven't done that, but this is actually how all the labels it's how all the diabetes labels read in the US. So this is the same for GLP-1s. And I think physicians are going to be pragmatic as well as patients in deciding how the baseline therapy is going to look like, which undoubtedly we need. And we, you know, that's the way we wanted to show it with a short pilot on gluten-free diets. We need to offer the patient something. But I don't think this is going to be a major restriction.
In the States, it's no restriction at all.
I don't think it's a restriction. I think it's exciting because we have to focus on it a bit more.
Louise, although in the States, we don't. I mean, it's in the label, and people pay as much, physician prescribers pay as much or as little attention to it as they choose. They just don't worry about it. One of the jokes around statins 25 years ago was that you were giving people license to eat more frankfurters and hamburgers and get their cholesterol down all at the same time. So the focus isn't on, okay, first let's do an extensive diet and exercise protocol. Let's track that protocol. Let's see how that works and then add drug if we have to. People tend to add drug earlier. Now, what's interesting, though, is that the labeling in the States talks about, we talked about this, I think, in the patient advocate episode a couple of weeks ago. The labeling in the States talks about the idea that the drug should be an adjunct to diet and exercise, but in reality, it tends to work the other way around, which is that primary care does not get particularly committed to treating a disease if they can't give a drug. But once they can give a drug, they're more likely to push on diet and exercise for the incremental benefit that it provides. So there are going to be all kinds of complexities around this, but I agree with you. It's helpful that all that is recommended, but how it gets used from country to country and specialty to specialty, I think, will be very different.
I really want to do a study where you randomize patients to GLP-1 or resmetirom or whatever we're going to do, or a personal trainer plus a free gym card, and see what's best. I can actually imagine that the PT is more
cost-effective. Or a nurse with a fibro scan.
We'll clone you, Louise.
What I'm thinking, though, is now you're in Scandinavia, and now we're back to Mr. Fit, right? Where, in fact, you could prove that if you get people to comply with lifestyle well enough and the drugs aren't that good, the lifestyle effect in the placebo group will swamp the drug effect. So to be careful what you wish for, you might get it category. I'm not sure what happens if that's what the result proves out in this case. That set cholesterol back 20 years. So we'll see. All right. We're getting to the bottom of the hour. This isn't the episode that I had in mind when we drew it up, but I like this one better. So I think that's good. Closing question. Look forward, say, 2 years. And what are the steps that you believe we will have taken that will actually help us do a better job of triaging patients and getting the ones who need therapy to therapy? And then if you want to go past that and get really ambitious, for those optimists out here, what we can do to then get patients to the right drug or the right course of therapy? We've talked about a bunch of things. What do we think is actually going to play out? Brave one, go first.
Quite tricky. I do think we will probably have at least, maybe not in 2 years, but I think we might have something that's a little bit amphib for to work as a first-line screening algorithm that can also be, you know, with all the interest now from the industry and so on, more sort of dispersed also to primary care is easier. So I'm not seeing anything, you know, replacing FibroScan as the second step in the near future. I do think we need this kind of two-level testing algorithm. I'm not seeing that in 2 years we will have, you know, something that's so much better than FibroScan that we can safely use it as a first-line test and stick to that. But I'm, of course, also hoping I'm wrong, because that would be nice if we have like a HB1AC for hepatology that primary care feels very safe to use, but maybe not seeing that within the next 2 years.
Yeah, my hope is for, you know, we've discussed this so briefly, to have more manpower actually be able to advise and counsel all these patients, have more physician assistants and nursing staff trained in providing some high-level recommendations and guiding all these patients and really increasing the manpower to deal with the patients that might be interested in receiving that treatment, because the lifestyle and exercise just doesn't do it for their liver. That's the challenge. You know, the workload, Louise mentioned, identifying the right patients, and I hope we're going to be able to contribute to some of that with our research.
So, Louise, I'm thinking that what Jörn just said is that our Louise cloning program needs to go forward in earnest.
Well, we do have a QI program that we have designed for that. That can be implemented. Funny enough, quality improvement, that it can go throughout specialities, because I think one of the things I'd like to see in the next 2 years is that we look at the high-risk groups, and we're focusing on our known high-risk menopausal, postmenopausal women, for me, obviously our diabetes population. So those programs have to be implemented cross-speciality, where we're going to get the right patients from, which is the beauty of the QI, because it's cardiology, primary care, physician's assistants, things like that, anybody we can use in that program. But you're not going to be able to just put hepatology nurses into these areas. For one reason, hepatology nurses are not specialists in MASLD and MASH. We're specialists in liver disease end stage, and a lot of this is upstream. So I think we're very good, like the physicians in our specialty areas, we have weaknesses, and it's strengthening those weaknesses across the board from a practical perspective. But patients are very good given the information and given the responses, and they want to try really hard. That whole aspect in that this next 2 years, I think they will be driving us. They know there's a drug there. Whilst it wasn't for resmetirom, I did see adverts in Canada for herbal liver, but they're talking about fatty liver on a TV screen, just adverts that you pick up. There was at least two or three of them. So there is a conversation going on a broader spectrum. So I think patients are going to be looking for us now. And I think that's always a nice place to be, because it drives GPs. It drives the right next decision. That's where I'd like to see it going in the next 2 years. Personally.
Mm-hmm. So as I'm listening to this, here's the thought I'm having. The testing that will work best will be the testing that empowers patients to do the right thing. A, by giving patients who are motivated cues for what to do. And then B, over time, by helping providers understand how to work with patients on this. The idea we started with, that different kinds of diets can all have an effect, is, I think, important, because that gives consumer choice, even in the absence of medication. You know, and now you can say, well, you can help yourself this way, or this way. And giving choice, I think, is a limited number of successful choices, is pivotal to behavior change. So I think that's issue number one. And then issue number two would be to figure out how to make the results of these tests readily understandable enough. The kind of thing Louise talks about, where you can watch patients, you can show them two numbers, and they can track themselves. That's pivotal number two. And then number three will be, as I think we're probably a year and a half or 2 years away from seeing significant consumer promotion of drugs themselves in the space, maybe even more than that in the States, and obviously more than that in Europe. But when we start educating patients that there's something they can do, then I think the rules will change fairly quickly once they believe that.
And now back to Roger.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. If you have any questions or comments about the content of this conversation or the entire episode, please put them in the review section of the page in which you downloaded this conversation, or send an email to questions@surfingmash.com. We're still working on next week's topic, but we've got two ideas and they're both great. Until then, stay safe, surf on. We'll see you on the podcast. Bye-bye now.